Caverin was truly enjoying his time in the motel, which was a word that he had never heard before. It was, charmingly, a hybrid of motor and hotel. How very clever. While the decor was rough around the edges, the place was a million times better than the posh resorts on the Black Sea, those unbearably shabby shacks featuring useless plumbing, stinking carpets, dirty sheets, and the worst examples of cheap furniture Russian factories could disgorge. Yet here, the linens were clean, the air fragrant, towels plentiful. The soap was even wrapped. It wasn't decorated with body hairs from prior guests. No vermin prowled the floors. And in the middle of the room was a television set. He flicked it on. He opened his attaché case, removed the guns and cleaned them, eyes shifting from the screen to weapons and back. A handsome newscaster was speaking into the camera. President Kennedy will arrive at Love Field in Dallas around noon tomorrow to attend a sold-out luncheon at the Dallas Trade Mart. More than 200,000 people are expected to greet the president as his motorcade makes its way through the city. Governor and Mrs. John Connolly will accompany the president and his lovely First Lady, Jacqueline. She is indeed lovely, Caverin reflected, noting a film clip of her waving to people outside the White House. He put the weapons away and perused the menu card on the bedside table. He lifted the beige receiver of the phone, reflecting how curious it was to make a call, even one as innocuous as this, and not worry about being listened to. He smiled as he tried to understand the cheerful but heavily accented voice of the woman who took his order. He chose a large T-bone steak, a Texas-sized baked potato, and a double helping of green beans. To drink, a large glass of milk. It was decadent, yes, but Mikhail Caverin had learned that as a spy, in the field or even at home, you could never be sure if any given meal was your last. Friday. At 6 a.m., Special Agent Anthony Barter pulled his Galaxy into the far end of the Dallas Roses parking lot. More or less refreshed after 3 hours' sleep, he climbed out of the car and walked casually toward the sedan containing the FBI surveillance team. Crouching, he asked the agent on the passenger side, "Anything?"
"Nope," drawled the man. "Nobody came or went."
"Any outside calls, in or out?" That, too, was negative. Nor had the spy used the payphone in the lobby. He hadn't left his room since his return from Piggly Wiggly. Barter found his hands making fists. Then, relaxing, he looked over at the Bel Air. "What do we do, Tony?"
"We wait till he exits, then follow him to see who he's rendezvousing with."
Barter's hope was that the spy was working with employees of LTO Incorporated, or one of the other big defense contractors here, whose engineers were designing sophisticated weaponry for the Army and Air Force. He was hoping to bring down a whole cell of traitors spying for the Soviets. He returned to his Galaxy, blinking as he noted a black sedan speed toward him and skid to a stop nearby. Barter was irritated. The Russian wouldn't have a view of this spot from his window, but the squealing stop might have put him on his guard. The driver leapt out and sprinted through traffic.
"The hell are you?"
Barter got no further than that. The young agent from his office was thrusting a telex into his hand. "Top secret. Urgent. Russian who entered country illegally 2 days ago identified as Mikhail Caverin, GRU agent. Specialty reported to be close-in assassination of double agents and other enemies."
Hell, he's not a spy, he's a killer.
And Barter suddenly understood why Caverin had come to town. Not to steal secrets, but to assist in an assassination attempt. It was too much of a coincidence that a trained GRU killer was here just prior to the president. True, the Soviets would never risk an international incident by being directly involved in an assassination, but one of their agents could easily have come here to protect someone else whose mission was to kill Kennedy, someone private without a direct connection to Russia, most likely a U.S. citizen.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
He explained his thinking.
"Caverin's here to back up an assassin. Maybe he's providing guns or acting as a bodyguard for the trigger man, or helping him with escape routes. I don't care if we break every bone in his body, but we're going to find out who he's helping. Move now!
With guns drawn, the agents ran to the door of Caverin's room and kicked their way in. Somehow, in his heart, Barter wasn't very surprised to find that the room's sole occupant was a bag of untouched groceries from Piggly Wiggly. Nor was it any shock that the back window was unlocked. Caverin looked out the window of his room in the Skyline Motel in North Dallas. The parking lot and road were clear. The agents who'd been on his tail were, of course, still at the first motel he'd checked into, the Dallas Rose in Grand Prairie. He'd become aware of a possible tail yesterday as he'd driven through the neighborhood of Old East Dallas, assessing risks, looking for anyone who might be unusually interested in him. He'd noted a Ford Galaxy, red body and white top. The car had been driving the opposite direction when he'd first seen it, but moments later it reappeared, following him. Caverin had left that area immediately and driven along commercial roads until he found the Piggly Wiggly and pulled in. The Galaxy followed. It, too, parked, and the driver sat there alone, not smoking, not reading. All he was doing was ostentatiously not looking toward the Bel Air. Clearly, this was suspicious. A man alone in a grocery store parking lot who was not waiting for his wife? He'd decided to find out the identity of his pursuer. So Caverin left his jacket, containing the Dallas Rose room key, on the back seat, and had gone into the grocery store, and he'd slipped out the back, circling around to the parking lot. Yes, there was a man who'd been tailing him, wearing a suit, an official-looking one. He'd sidled up to the Bel Air, looking around casually. Too casually. Eased the door open and went through the interior. Caverin himself had hurried to the man's Ford Galaxy and found the registration. Anthony Barter. He found nothing of the man's affiliation, but he'd hurried back to the Piggly Wiggly and used one of the store's payphones, which, unlike in Russia, actually worked. He had had to make only 3 calls, to the Dallas police, to the Texas Rangers, and to the FBI, asking for an Anthony Barter. The secretary at the last of the 3 had started to put him through to Special Agent Barter's office. He'd hung up, bought a sack's worth of random groceries, and returned to his Bel Air. The agent had left by then, but when Caverin had returned to the Dallas Rose, he saw that, yes, the Galaxy was parked across the street. Caverin had taken the groceries, gone inside, put on the TV, and then quickly gathered his belongings and climbed out the back window. He'd made his way through a field to a bus stop and had ridden a mile, then gotten off near a car dealership. He'd bought a 4-year-old DeSoto Fire Dome coupe, huge and with impressive rear fins, with some of the $1,000 Spesky had given him in Miami. He'd driven north until he found another motel, the Skyline. It was here that he'd spend the night, watching television, cleaning his weapons again, and enjoying the sumptuous steak dinner. Now it was time to complete his mission. According to Rasnikov, Luis Suarez and Carlos Barquin would be arriving at the boarding house soon to prepare for the killing of Comrade 35. Caverin left the hotel and was at the boarding house in 20 minutes. He parked the DeSoto across the street, slipping the smaller of the guns, the Colt 22, into his waistband. He got out and opened the trunk, set the jack and tire iron on the grass beside the car, and rested the spare tire against the bumper. And he waited. 15 minutes later, a yellow Chrysler pulled slowly down the street, 2 men in the front seat, men with mustaches and observant eyes. Yes, they were his targets. Caverin's hand eased into his jacket, gripped the handle of his pistol. It didn't make much noise, just a pop, like a bigger gun with a silencer, but it was much more accurate. He was breathing steadily, focusing on finding that unique place within you where you had to tuck your soul away when you took a human life. He murdered for his country, for the cause of what was just, for communism, for his own self-preservation. He was efficient at this dark task, even if he didn't enjoy it. He knew he was ready, and flicked the safety catch off the gun as he crouched down, watching the Chrysler in the reflection of his car's chrome bumper. It was then that a voice from behind startled Caverin.
Need some help there, sir?
Still facing the Chrysler, he looked back to see a Dallas police officer standing on the sidewalk, hands on his hips.
"I'm sorry?"
the spy asked evenly.
"Have a flat? Need some help?"
"No, I'm doing fine, thank you, officer."
Caverin was speaking over his shoulder with his back to the officer. His jacket was open and the pistol obvious.
"Don't mind helping, really,"
the man drawled. Caverin casually fixed buttons, but as he did, he looked across the street and saw his two targets staring his way. Perhaps they thought the police and he were working together, looking for them. Or maybe the officer's voice had simply caught their attention and they'd seen the pistol. In any event, the driver, it was Luis Suarez, aborted the parking maneuver, put the car in forward, and eased into the street. He didn't speed away, not just yet. But once the Chrysler turned the corner, Caverin heard the big engine accelerate fast. He turned back to the policeman and gave an appreciative smile.
"I've gotten everything taken care of, officer. Thank you, though."
"Anytime,"
the man said and returned to his beat. At around 8:30 a.m., Lee Harvey Oswald was being driven to work at the Texas Book Depository by a friend. He often did this, bummed rides. He didn't have a license and, in fact, didn't enjoy driving. He had mixed feelings about his decision to spend the night at the Payne's house in Irving. It was smart because it provided a good hiding place from those bastards who wanted to kill him. He'd looked forward to seeing Marina and their two daughters, one of whom was only a month old. They were staying permanently with the Paynes. But that turned out to be a disappointment. He'd hoped to reconcile with Marina after a recent fight, but it hadn't happened. The bickering resumed. The night had turned to shit, and he was upset.
"What you got back there?"
his friend asked as they nosed through morning traffic. He was nodding toward the long, paper-wrapped bundle in the back seat.
"Just some curtain rods."
"Ah!"
Oswald continued to be cautious, shifting his gaze around the surrounding streets and sidewalks. Yes, some people seemed to be watching him, wary, suspicious, as if they knew exactly what he was going to do today. He reflected that he had told too many people about his contempt for Kennedy, and hell, he'd just written an angry letter to the FBI warning them to leave his family alone. That wasn't too bright. And curtain rods? Jesus. No, it's a 6.5mm Carcano Model 9138 rifle. That's what was wrapped up in the paper. How could anybody believe the bulky package was curtain rods? You need to think better, be smarter, and be cautious. He had a sense that his enemies were getting closer and closer. He had the chance to make an indelible mark on history. He'd be famous forever. He had to make absolutely sure nothing would prevent that. He looked around the streets of central Dallas, partially deserted now. There'd be crowds later, that was for sure. Right there along Elm Street. Thousands of people. He knew this because the local newspaper had conveniently reported the exact route the president's motorcade would take. The vehicles would come west on Main, then north briefly on Houston, then turn west again on Elm, passing right under the windows of the Texas Book Depository, where he would be waiting on a sixth-floor window.
"You okay there, Lee?"
his friend asked as he eased to a stop at a light.
"What's that?"
"You didn't hear me, I guess. I just asked if you'd be needing a ride back to the Paynes tonight."
Oswald didn't answer for a minute.
"No, I'll probably just take the bus."
"There, that's a good place to shoot,"
Luis Suarez said. Carlos Barquin was examining the intersection where his partner was pointing, the sidewalk in front of the side door to the Texas Book Depository.
"Looks like the only place to shoot. Good or bad, we don't have any choice. Where else could we do it?"
He seemed impatient. Suarez nodded, though he didn't much care for the man's attitude.
"Not very private, though."
"Well, we don't have the luxury of private, not with a paranoid asshole like him."
They had parked their Chrysler on North Record Street in downtown Dallas and were looking over the sidewalk in front of the Texas Book Depository. The morning was chill, but they kept their jackets buttoned up because of the guns in their waistbands.
"I think it'll work. All the buildings, they'll cover the sounds of the shots."
"Cover them?"
Barquin asked.
"I mean, the sounds will bounce around. Nobody will know where they came from."
Oh.
Nobody'll know it was us. We'll shoot him, drop the guns, and walk back to the car. Walk slowly.
The pistols were wrapped in a special tape that didn't hold fingerprints. Barkeen said defiantly,
I know what to do. I've done this before.
Suarez didn't say anything. He and Barkeen shared both a certain ideology and a love of liquor. They'd even shared the same woman once or twice. He didn't really like the man, however. As they continued through the cool morning, Barkeen asked,
That man, back there at the boarding house, in the suit talking to the cop, he was police too, you think?
I don't know.
Suarez had pondered who he'd been. He'd been armed and had been talking to that patrolman, but it would have been odd for a cop to be there changing the tire of his own unmarked car. And an old DeSoto? No, the man was trouble, but he couldn't figure out how he fit into the picture. They had some effects back at the boarding house, which they'd stashed there last week, but they'd have to abandon them now. Not that it mattered. They could pick up whatever they needed on the road as the underground spirited them out of the country and back to Havana. As they walked up Houston toward Elm, they passed a dim alley. A car was parked there, rear end facing them, the engine running and the trunk open. What was familiar about it?
That car, haven't we?
And Suarez realized it was the same DeSoto parked in front of the boarding house earlier when they'd seen that man changing the tire. The big, blonde man. It was his car, which meant... He turned quickly, barking too, and both instinctively reached for their weapons, but the man was approaching fast from across Houston Street, already aiming his own gun at them. The two Cubans froze. Without a hesitation, without a blink, without breaking stride, the hulking blonde man fired twice, hitting Barkeen in the forehead. Pop, pop. He dropped to the ground like a discarded doll. Suarez decided there was no choice. He continued to draw his gun and hoped he could get a round off in time. The weapon wasn't even out of his waistband when he saw a tiny flash, then felt a tap between his eyes. A burning. Which lasted less than a second. Caverin got the bodies into the trunk of the DeSoto quickly. This was effortless. They were slight, weighing half what he did. He fired up the DeSoto. He liked the Bel Air better. And pulled into Houston Street and then made his way out of downtown. The search to find the men had been tense, though he'd known in general where they'd be going, the most likely place to shoot down Comrade 35. Once there, central Dallas, he'd cruised the streets looking for a yellow Chrysler. Finally, he'd spotted it, near North Record Street. Suarez and Barkeen were just getting out and walking south. There were too many people to kill them there, but Caverin had noted the route they were taking, and he'd pulled into an alley several blocks ahead of them. Once again, he'd opened the trunk, then slipped into a doorway across Houston Street and waited. The men strode up the avenue, and when their attention turned to the DeSoto, he'd stepped across the street, drawing his gun. Pop, pop. Caverin now drove out of the downtown area, parked, and walked up the street to the Western Union office he'd located earlier. There, the spy spent some moments with a cipher pad writing a telegram reporting his success. He sent it to a safe house in Washington, D.C., where someone from the Russian consulate was waiting. In 15 minutes, the response came back. It referred to shipments of wheat and truck allotments. But after deciphering, have submitted to the special counsel of the Presidium the report regarding your successful elimination of the threat to Comrade 35. Please proceed to any locations where the two counter-revolutionaries had contact in Dallas and secure any helpful information. The people of the Soviet Union thank you. Caverin returned to the boarding house in the old East Dallas part of town, opened the trunk of the DeSoto after making sure no one could see him and no beat police officers were nearby, and emptied the pockets of the men he'd just shot. He found a fob containing the key to the front door of the boarding house and one to room number 2. He walked slowly up to the front door, checked to make sure he was alone, and then entered their room. The men had not been inside that morning, after the scare with the police, but they had apparently stored some things there, several suitcases containing clothes, money, ammunition, binoculars, and Spanish to English dictionaries. He pulled out a penknife and began to look for secret compartments. He found none. At about 12:45, he heard a commotion from the hallway, voices speaking urgently. He thought at first it might be the police, that he'd been tracked here or that someone had seen an unidentified man entering the boarder's room. His hand on the pistol, he walked to the door, leaned close, and listened.
"Did you hear? Did you hear?"
a woman was calling, the words sliced by hysteria.
"The president's been shot! They think he's dead!"
"No, are you sure?"
a man's voice. Someone began to sob. Caverin released his grip on the Colt, looked around the room, and walked to the television set. He turned it on and sat in a creaking chair to wait for the device to warm up.
Saturday. The time was 2 a.m., the day after the worst day of his life. Special Agent Anthony Barter was trudging along the sidewalk to his apartment in Richmond, Texas. He'd been up for nearly 24 hours, and he needed a little sleep. Just a nap, really, and then a shower. Then he'd return to the hunt for Lee Harvey Oswald's assistant or savior or bodyguard or whatever he was. The Russian spy, Mikhail Kavrin. The fallout was bad. Barter had kept his own superiors at the FBI and the Secret Service informed of every fact he'd learned about the spy from the moment he'd gotten the report from New York. But it was finger-pointing time now, and Washington wanted to know exactly, minute by minute, what he knew and when he knew it and why he wasn't more vocal about the threat to Kennedy. "Because it wasn't a threat at first," he'd explained to the assistant director of the FBI in Washington. "We thought he was after classified weapons information. His behavior was suspicious, but he didn't seem dangerous." The assistant director had barked.
"Well, the President of the United States is now suspiciously dead, Barter. I thought you were tailing him."
Barter had sighed.
"I was. He evaded me."
He didn't say us. Barter didn't shift blame.
"Jesus Christ!"
The man told him that J. Edgar Hoover personally would be calling him at some point tomorrow, and slammed the phone down. At least that's what Barter imagined. He heard only a click, then static. So this is what the demise of a career looks like, he thought, his heart clutched. Being a special agent was the only job that had ever appealed to him, the only job he'd ever wanted. His passion for the FBI went back to seeing newsreels about G-Men, to reading comic books about Elliot Ness, to watching movies like Gangbusters over and over again at Saturday afternoon matinees while munching popcorn and sipping fizzy grape soda pop. But his future wasn't the first thing in his mind at the moment. All he cared about was finding Lee Harvey Oswald's accomplice, finding Caverin. For a moment he was flushed with anger, and he hoped that, if he found the man, the Russian resisted arrest so Barter could put a bullet in his head. Even as he thought this, though, he knew it was an unreasonable, passionate reflex. The reality was that he would arrest the man, following procedure to a T, and interrogate him firmly but respectfully. The problem, of course, was finding him. Since he'd been Oswald's protector and the assassin was now in custody, Caverin was probably long gone. Barter guessed he was probably on a steamer headed back to Russia. Still, Barter was doing everything possible to find the man. The instant he'd heard of the shooting, he had sent the Russian's picture to every law enforcer in Texas and neighboring states and made sure the nearby airports and the train and bus stations were being watched. The automobile rental agencies, too. Ironically, the Texas Book Depository was crowned with a huge Hertz billboard touting Chevrolets. Roadblocks were set up as well, and the docks along the Texas coastline were being searched by local police, FBI, and the Coast Guard. As every minute passed without word of a sighting, Barter grew more and more angry with himself. Oh, hell, if he'd only done more digging. Oswald had been under investigation by agents in his own office. The man had tried to defect to Russia. He was actively pro-communist and had recently been in Mexico trying to get visas to Cuba and Russia. If that investigation had been better coordinated, Barter might have put the pieces together. Now, approaching his apartment, Anthony Barter paused, fishing out his keys, and stepped to his door, thinking, "Okay, I'll have one Lone Star beer." Yes, agents were not supposed to drink, but considering that tomorrow Mr. Hoover would tell him that he was soon to be an ex-agent, liquor was one vice that he wouldn't have to worry about keeping secret any longer. Barter walked inside, closed the door, and locked it. He was reaching for the light switch when he heard behind him a floorboard creak. Special Agent Anthony William Barter's shoulders slumped. He thought of his failure to the Bureau, to his country, and to his president. He was almost relieved when the Russian agent's pistol muzzle touched the back of his head.
"How the hell did you find me?"
Anthony Barter asked. Mikhail Kavarin briefly studied the FBI agent, whose hands were shackled with his own cuffs. The Russian was impressed that the man seemed merely curious, not afraid. He returned to his task, which was using a penknife to slice open the lining of his attaché case. Barter noted this surgery, but seemed uninterested in it. His gaze was fixed ruthlessly on his visitor.
"How did I find you?"
Kavarin mused, slicing away. He explained about observing the agent's surveillance at the grocery store.
"You saw me?"
"Yes, yes, we are trained to notice that. Aren't you?"
"Not many people follow FBI agents. It's usually the other way around."
This made some sense. He explained about his ruse at the Piggly Wiggly. The FBI man squinted his eyes shut in disgust. Then he sighed.
"Okay, you didn't kill me," Barter said evenly. "So you're going to kidnap me? Negotiate my life a safe passage out of the country?"
He then said in a low, defiant voice,
"But that isn't going to work, my friend. We don't negotiate with scum like you. Assassination's the most cowardly act imaginable. You and your countrymen are despicable, and whatever you do to me, you won't stop our entire law enforcement apparatus from finding you and making sure you're arrested and executed. And there will be sanctions against your country, you know? Military sanctions."
He shook his head in seeming disbelief.
"Didn't your superiors think through what would happen if the president was killed?"
Kavarin didn't respond. He turned his attention to the agent.
"We have not made introductions. I am Major Mikhail Kavarin of the Glavno Razvedyelvatelno Upravlenie."
"I know who you are."
Kavarin wasn't surprised. He said,
"Well, Special Agent Barter, I have no intention of kidnapping you, nor of killing you, for that matter. I found it necessary to come up behind you and relieve you of your weapon so that you would not act rashly."
"Shooting an enemy of the country, a spy, is not acting rashly."
Kavarin said,
"No, but shooting an ally would be."
"Ally?"
"Agent Barter, I am going to tell you some things you will undoubtedly find incredible, though they are true. Then after we make some formal arrangements, I will give you your gun back, and I will give you my gun, and I will surrender to you. May I proceed?"
Warily, Barter said,
"Yes, all right."
His eyes shifted from the pistol to the documents extracted from the lid of the attaché case.
"Earlier this week, I was called into the office of my superior at GRU headquarters. I was given an assignment to protect an individual in the United States who would further the interests of the Soviet Union. A man we have codenamed Comrade 35.
"Yeah, yeah, you son of a bitch, Lee Harvey Oswald."
"No," Kavarin said. "Comrade 35 was our codename for John Fitzgerald Kennedy."
"What?"
Barter squinted at him.
35, Kavarin continued, "because he was the 35th president of the United States. Comrade because he shared certain interests with our country."
The Russian pushed forward the documents he'd extracted from his case.
"Can you read Russian?"
"No."
"Then I will translate."
"They're fake."
"No, they are quite real, and I will prove to you they are real in a moment."
Kavarin looked down and scanned the documents.
"To Comrade Major Mikhail Kavarin, intelligence received from sources in Washington, D.C., has reported that in October of this year, President John Fitzgerald Kennedy signed an executive order initiating the reduction of American advisory and military forces in Vietnam."
"Vietnam?"
Barter was frowning.
"That's that country near China, right? A French colony or something?"
"Sure, we've sent some soldiers there. I read about that." Kavarin continued his reading.
"Our sources have reported that Charles de Gaulle told President Kennedy that it would be very detrimental for the United States to become enmeshed in the politics of Southeast Asia. Kennedy went against the advice of his generals and established the goal to have all American troops out of Vietnam and neighboring countries by 1964. After the Americans are gone, the communist regimes in Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia will surge south through Malaysia and Singapore, establishing governments with true Marxist values throughout Southeast Asia. Our premier and the Politburo will form an alliance with that bloc. Together we will stand firm against the wrong-minded Maoist cult in China. If anything were to happen to Kennedy, our intelligence assessment is that his successor, Lyndon Johnson, will drastically increase the U.S. military presence in the region. This would be disastrous for the interests of the USSR.
He put down the documents, shook his head, and sighed.
You see, Agent Barter, the mission of the agent who preceded me and of myself was to do whatever we could to uncover any threats to your President Kennedy and stop them. Our job was to protect him.
Barter snapped. That's bullshit.
You knew about Oswald but didn't report it. If you'd really been concerned, you...
No,
Caverin replied angrily.
We knew nothing of Oswald. That's not why I was sent here. There was another threat to your president, completely unrelated to the assassin. Do you know of Luis Suarez and Carlos Barquin?
Of course. We've been on the lookout for them for months. They're Cuban-Americans under orders from Fidel Castro to kill Kennedy because of the Bay of Pigs invasion. We haven't been able to find their whereabouts.
I can produce them.
Where are they?
They're in the trunk of my car.
Are you joking?
Not at all. That was my assignment, to find and eliminate them. We knew they were going to attempt to assassinate Kennedy, possibly on his visit here. When I shot them, they were on Houston Street, at a place where your president's motorcade would pass by. Undoubtedly, they were looking for vantage points to shoot from. Both of them were armed.
Why didn't you tell us you had a lead to them?
Caverin scoffed.
What would you have done?
Arrested them, of course.
For what? Have they committed a crime?
Barter fell silent.
I thought not. You would have put them away for a few months for threatening the president or for having a weapon. Then they would have been released to try to assassinate him again. My solution was far more efficient and far more permanent.
Caverin grimaced. He said passionately,
No one was more shocked and upset than I to hear the terrible news today of your president's fate.
Caverin fell silent, noting that Barter, who until now had been looking him straight in the eye, had grown evasive. The Russian said in a whisper,
You knew about Oswald.
No answer for a moment. Then,
I'm not at liberty to talk about investigations.
Caverin snapped.
You knew he was a threat, and yet you were not watching him constantly?
We have limited resources. We didn't think he'd be a threat.
Silence flowed between the men. Finally, Caverin asked softly,
Well, do you believe me, Special Agent Barter?
After a moment, the FBI man said,
Maybe I do, but you haven't told me what you want out of all this.
Caverin gave a laugh.
It's obvious, no? I want to defect. I have failed my mission. If I return home, I will become a non-person. I will be killed and my name and all record of my existence expunged. It will be as if I never existed. I had hoped to marry, even at this age, to have a son. That is a possibility if I remain here.
He gave a faint smile.
Besides, I must tell you, Agent Barter, I have been in this country for only several days, but I already find it rather appealing.
What's in it for us?
I can give you a great deal of information. I have been a GRU officer for many years, and I can offer something more, something to, as your card players here say, sweeten the pot.
Barter said, And what's that?
What I can offer you, Agent Barter, excuse me, Special Agent Barter, is a real, living, breathing KGB agent.
KGB?
Indeed, you can arrest him and interrogate him, or your CIA could run him as a double agent. You Americans love KGB spies, do you not? Why, your citizens know nothing of the GRU or the Stasi.
But the KGB?
Pick up a James Bond novel or go to the cinema. Wouldn't it be a fine national security coup to land a fish like that?
Caverin put just the right tone into his voice to suggest that the arrest would be fine for Barter's career personally, too.
Who is this man? He is in Miami, operating undercover as the head of a transportation company. His real name is Nikolai Spesky. He purports to be a GRU agent, but in fact his employer is the KGB.
How do you know that?
For one thing, because of your presence on my trail.
Me?
Caverin said.
I assume you learned of me through an anonymous tip, correct?
Yes, that's right. Received by our New York office.
Perhaps through New York, but it originated from Comrade Spesky in Miami. He informed on me. You see, neither customs officials or any airline in New York knew that my final destination was Dallas. Only Spesky did. I didn't receive my ticket until I was in Florida. In fact, I wasn't wholly surprised when you appeared. I was suspicious of Spesky from the beginning. That is one of the reasons I was looking for surveillance. And spotted you.
Why did you suspect him?
Top brand vodka and pâté and smoked oysters and bread with very little malt?
Barter shook his head. Caverin continued.
Spesky told me his wife had sent him such gifts from Moscow. No GRU field agent's wife would ever be able to afford such delicacies. Only the wife of a KGB agent could.
But why would he betray you?
Wouldn't the KGB have the same interest you would?
To keep the president alive so he'd withdraw the troops from Vietnam?
Caverin smiled again.
Logic would suggest that, yes. But in truth, the essential interest of the KGB is in furthering the interest of the KGB. And that cause is advanced every time the GRU fails.
So, your security agencies spy on each other for no other purpose than sabotaging their rivals?
Barter muttered, his tone dark. Caverin fixed him with a piercing look.
Yes, shocking, isn't it? Something that could never happen here. Fortunately, you have Mr. J. Edgar Hoover to uphold the moral integrity of your organization. I know he would never illegally wiretap politicians or civil rights leaders or members of other governmental agencies.
Anthony Barter offered his first smile of the evening. He said,
I can't make any deals myself, you understand that?
Of course. But I think you're telling the truth. I'll go to bat for you.
You know what that means?
Caverin gave a broad frown.
Please, I am a fan of the New York Mets.
Barter laughed.
The Mets? They had close to the worst season in Major League history this year. Couldn't you pick a better team?
Caverin waved his hand dismissively.
It was their second year as a team. Give them some time, Agent Barter. Give them time.
The Russian then slid the photographs of the top-secret documents toward the agent, along with the keys to the DeSoto. He uncuffed the agent and, without a moment's hesitation, handed over both of the pistols.
I'm going to make some calls, Major Caverin. I hope you won't mind if I put the handcuffs on you.
No, I perfectly understand.
He slipped them on, albeit with Caverin's hands in front of him, not behind his back. Before he reached for the phone, though, he asked,
Would you like to have a beer?
I would, yes. In Russia we have vodka, but we don't have beer. Not good beer.
The agent rose and went to the refrigerator. He returned with two bottles of Lone Star, opened them, and handed one to the spy. Caverin lifted his.
«За здоровье!» It means to our health.
They tapped bottles and both took long sips, Caverin enjoying the flavor very much, and the FBI agent regarded the bottle with pleasure.
I'm not supposed to be doing this, you know. Mr. Hoover doesn't approve of drinking liquor.
No one will ever know, Special Agent Barter,
Caverin told him.
I'm quite good at keeping secrets.
Tuesday. Top Secret. November 26, 1963. From Office of the Secretary of Defense, the Pentagon, Arlington, Virginia. To Secretary of the Army, Secretary of the Navy, Secretary of the Air Force, Secretary of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Be advised that President Lyndon Baines Johnson today issued National Security Action Memorandum 273. This order reverses NSAM 263, issued by the late President Kennedy in October of this year, which ordered the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Vietnam and the transfer of responsibility in countering communist insurgency in Southeast Asia to the Vietnamese and neighboring governments. NSAM 273 provides for maintenance of existing U.S. troop strength in Vietnam and sets forth a commitment to increased American military and advisory presence in combating communism in the region.